5 days ago, I received an email from Bram Kleppner, Amy Kleppner's son, informing me that his mother, daughter of Muriel Earhart Morrissey and niece of Amelia Earhart, had sadly passed away. The subject line of the email read, Amy's last day. Back in April, I said this in the opening of Bram's episode, and I'll say it again here. Amy was a wonderful representation of both her mother and her aunt, and tonight, she is with both. The following episode is lovingly dedicated to the memory of Amy Kleppner. Now, on with the show. Nearly a year ago, the Amelia Earhart story was rocked by a mysterious and compelling sonar image produced by ocean exploration company Deep Sea Vision. The suspiciously plane-shaped image, taken in an area out in the Pacific near Howland Island, rattled the case to its core and forced a full investigative stop while the world anxiously awaited a confirmation. As history was potentially unfolding, I welcome Deep Sea Vision's CEO, Tony Romeo, to the podcast in his Chasing Earhart debut, and we discuss the possibility of his find being the beginning of the end for the Amelia Earhart Fred Noonan disappearance case. Well, you know how that goes. Tonight, 10 months after that episode was recorded, Tony returns to look back in retrospect on that conversation and discuss the most recent developments in the deep ocean search for the Holy Grail of aviation. You know, it is Friday the 13th, and people do say this case is cursed. You think there's something to that? Just when you think the investigation may be over, it throws us yet another curveball and puts us all right back where we were before. The plot thickens indeed, so let's get to work. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. Fresh back from deep in the Pacific Ocean, this is Tony Romeo. And we're live. Tony, welcome back, sir. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. Of course.
Wasn't sure you'd have me back after we found out that it was just rocks.
Oh, this is just getting started. This is a 90-year-old case, damn near. We have lots to talk about, of course. We are sitting down for this almost 10 months ago to the night from the first time we did this. A lot has happened, obviously, since then. A little over a month ago, you gave the world a much, much anticipated update in your search for Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. I know it obviously wasn't the update you probably wanted to give. I'm going to just ask you the same opening question to start tonight that I asked you 10 months ago. What have the last several weeks been like for you since these newest developments have become public?
Well, thanks for having me back again. Yeah, it was obviously a real disappointment. No question about that. We really thought we had a very promising target. But, you know, at the same time, we always acknowledged that it could be something else. We thought it could be another plane, could have been rocks, could have been something else man-made that was just in a weird shape. We didn't go with the champagne bottle open, right? We were waiting to see what we had. We were prepared to continue searching if it wasn't a plane. So the whole thing has been a kind of a work in progress for everybody that's gone before us, from Dana Timmer to David Jordan, Ted Waite. Yeah. It's another chapter in the story, and it continues. And the sonar technology gets, I tell you, what we were able to do, just simply because we're later in time compared to what some of the earlier folks were able to do and how fast we were able to search, is just incredible. And 10 years from now, they're going to look back and look at us and say, wow, Deep Sea Vision was very slow and not very thorough, and better data and better higher resolution of everything. And then 10 years, you know, so it's just going to continue. I mean, we're not that far out when we're going to have completely autonomous AUVs out there without being on a ship. We're not far from that at all right now. And when that day comes, this mystery will probably be solved within, you know, a few years.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Well, look, 2 points I want to make as we begin here tonight. First, I think anyone, and we'll link it for people who haven't heard it, I think anyone that's listened to our first conversation will know that I'm not kidding when I say this. You really want to find them. I know how strongly you felt about that target. You put everything you had into it. You went all in. You got people excited about the Earhart story again. You know, you mentioned it tonight. We've talked about it in our first conversation. Sometimes it doesn't work out the way you want, or sometimes there's a bump in the road, or sometimes it's just a little bit longer. And look, like I said at the start of this, it's been 90 years almost. This case is not easy for a reason. My second point I wanted to make is, you mentioned it, you're not stopping. You're going to keep going. And I really admire that. I love that. The case desperately needs that. You've gone out, you've got some updates. Where does Deep Sea Vision go in the Earhart case, just in general from here now?
You know, I think the big lesson learned for us walking out of this last expedition was, so two conclusions. Do we continue going out, right? So if you were to draw a circle or an oval around Howland Island, do you continue going out or do you come back in? And what I mean by that is, did we miss it? Did Dana Timmer miss it? Did David Jordan miss it, right? We ended up doing, just because we felt like some of the really early data was not maybe great because it was earlier technology, we ended up redoing a lot of Dana Timmer stuff, some of David Jordan's areas, some of the more difficult areas. But we sort of all have to, you know, you and I talked about this idea of collaboration, right? We all have to work together. We all also have to kind of trust each other that we're reviewing the data in a thorough way, that we're not missing it behind a valley, that we're not leaving too many holidays out there. That's our first direction for us, is do we continue going out and widen the circle into lower, lower and lower probability areas? Or do we come back in and redo areas that we weren't certain about or areas that we feel had a lot of holidays and big dark shadows behind hills and valleys and ravines and things like that? And that goes for our data just as much as everybody else's. So how confident and how big of a percentage is that? Maybe it's 2 to 3, 4, maybe 5%. I don't think it's more than 5%. I think we come back in now and start really filling in the holes of where we were. And then the second conclusion, just food for thought, is which camp do you now fall into? Is this a flying mistake or was this a math mistake, right?
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time on the boat talking about this. If you're in the flying mistake camp, that means she was flying into the island, dead reckoned wrong. Maybe her compass wasn't calibrated properly. Something that they did, it wasn't their fault, but it caused them to fly. They didn't know the winds and they just flew incorrectly. They passed the island, things like that. Or do you say that this was a math mistake? Fred Noonan just didn't calculate the sunline correctly. His chronometer was off. He didn't calculate that correctly when he left Lay. Did he have a mistake in celestial navigation? Like Gary Laputa suggested, maybe one was north and one was south, and it caused the trajectory of the offset to be clearly way off in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So if you believe it was a flying error, in other words, that she just was 10% off as she was gradually flying along, which we've always sort of believed, then that puts her somewhere near the island. If you believe it's a math mistake, a dateline theory, for example, like Liz Smith suggested, and we have not searched all the area that Liz Smith has suggested, so it could still be in there. But if it's a math error, like the dateline theory, then that opens up so many possibilities of where she could be, right? She could, in fact, be way down south, right? She could be far north in Marshall Islands. That opens up a lot of different ideas. And I don't know. And that's where I think I lose a lot of sleep, is I don't know. And we'll never know the answer to that. So it's, you kind of have to kind of pick, or could be one, a little bit of both. She's not flying. Mm. She's not dead reckoning well. And she's not following Fred Noonan's instructions well. And Fred also has taken a wrong sunline, hasn't measured correctly, or he's doing his math too quickly, and he messes up. So you're either in one of those two, I think, primarily, and then you just kind of have to decide on where to go after that.
Yeah, well, and you know, one of the things we talked about in the first conversation we had, and one of the things I think you were proudest of, and one of the things you were most passionate about, is, you know, the sit downs you did with schools and a lot of the young people that are following this case and are interested in Amelia Earhart, whether it's for her legacy or whether it's disappearance or whatever it is. What do you say to people who are following this thing with such intensity, who love what you do, who are just, they just want to see it in, just like you? When you have a setback like this, does your outlook outweigh the difficulty?
You know, obviously putting out news that you failed or you weren't successful is always hard. I think that's important, as consider ourselves researchers and scientists looking for answers. So we have nothing to hide, and we've always felt that way. And we went out with that attitude when we went on the first expedition. We went out on the second expedition with the same outlook, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive. And I actually was expecting more folks to come out and say, oh, told you so, it wasn't there. And in fact, the response was surprisingly, and I say surprisingly, but very pleasant and very, you know, encouraging us to go back out and continue searching. And I was kind of surprised by that. The first sonar picture that we released got folks kind of re-engaged in the whole mystery again. And we were the first ones to ever release a sonar image of something that could have been the plane. And I think, you know, folks really kind of recentered folks back on, okay, this is really where she's at. And all these kind of crazy ideas of being a POW or flying back to Buka, nothing. You know, I know.
We'll get there.
You know, it recentered it back where it needs to be. And she is probably not far from Howland. We will know, probably, I would say for sure, in the next 10 years at some point. Overwhelmingly, all the emails and the letters and the schools and the kids are like, go back and do it. We really are so excited about it. We really want to know where she went down now. And yeah, you're right about the schools. That's been the most fun, is going to classrooms, and the kids have no qualms asking all kinds of questions, right? Or did you find bodies in the plane? I'm like, did you, you know, all the crazy stuff. Did they get eaten by sharks? And like the questions the kids ask are just so fascinated. It's been fun, but they've also been like really intrigued by the mystery of it. You know, what were they doing? Why were they flying around the world? What was the, you know, early aviation about? And it's opened a lot of kids' eyes to, I think, science and math and STEM research.
Yeah.
travel in general, ocean conservation. So it's terrific in so many other ways other than just Amelia, which is exciting. Yeah,
absolutely. When the announcement was made, you called it the cruelest formation ever created by nature, which yeah. I love that description. I love that description. Let's talk a little bit about some of those possibilities now that we're sort of at this point. I mean, you're a logistics guy, obviously you're a numbers guy, math doesn't lie. You know, when it comes to deep ocean, like you mentioned, the area is absolutely, I think, shrinking, and that can only really be good for the odds of the case moving forward. Statistically speaking, I think it's only a matter of time, as you and I share that sentiment. People ask me this all the time, and you know, we'll get to Buca in a minute, but if it's there, it's toast. You know, it's kind of a whole different ball game there. But I just spoke with Tom Detweiler, and speaking of time frames, you know, his episode directly precedes this one. The phrase he gave me was tens of years. And if it's in the deep ocean, we're looking at about tens of years left before it becomes maybe impossible to recover. It deteriorates too far. Does that concern you? Does that add a sense of urgency, or do you just not really think about that?
Yeah, I don't like to think about that as much, because it's kind of discouraging, right? If the plane were to dissolve away. Because it's aluminum, my understanding is it would be in pretty good condition for several hundred years. But, you know, I would never disagree with anything Tom Detweiler says. I don't think any of us would. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him and everything he's done over the years. So I don't have a good answer. I know, I mean, at 6,000 meters, you're in an environment that's very stable. There's no light. It is extremely cold. There's no friction. There's very little movement. The pH as well, there's no free oxygen. So you couldn't ask for a better environment for conservation. The rate at which SAS and AUV technology in general is advancing, and the ability to one day put these on a boat not too far in the distant future and let the boat run the AUV, launch and recover without humans on board, then the whole thing is over. And it kind of saddens me in a way, because I think there's a little bit more excitement to a crew out on a boat, finding her, doing the expedition properly, whatever properly means. But in the future, it'll be much cheaper and much easier. And, you know, you can run this thing for years out there. And at some point, Google is probably going to map the entire, they'll probably buy a couple hundred of these things and just map the entire ocean floor, and every single plane ever lost will be found. So that's not too far away, I don't think. Yeah, I mean, I think he's probably right, tens of years. I do think, Amelia, I think it's a big enough story that, and from the interest we've heard from folks, calls and stuff, I think we'll get an answer on this one in the next 10 years. That would be my prediction.
Yeah, I'm with you. The sooner the better. Well, speaking of narrowing it down, you've touched a little bit on Buca. You mentioned the Marshall Islands earlier. Now comes a part of the conversation I think that everybody that I've talked to in the last couple of weeks, since you and I have talked about doing this again, have lovingly demanded me to ask you about. I think I can spoil it publicly. You have talked to Bill Snavely off the record, right?
You guys have had it?
Okay.
Very pleasant conversation. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for what he's doing, and very professional sort of disagreement on here, but nothing but respect for what he's doing. I think with one exception in the community, I mean, everybody had been very wonderful, and the Amelia story is so interesting and fun to be a part of, you know, and everybody that's been a part of that, it's been a great community, and Bill is a part of that. David Jordan's part of that. Tom, of course, Dana Timmer, and then, you know, Purdue University. So yeah, no, it's been terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talked a little bit about technology. We've touched on it a little bit tonight. The Huygen is a very impressive piece of technology, and you've got one of the only ones in the world. We have a lot of nerds that listen to this show that love underwater technology, that love this stuff. We didn't get to this last time, really. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what the Huygen does. What separates this piece of equipment from what's out there now? We've talked about what's happening in the future, potentially, but this is really the most advanced AUV in the world right now. What does it do? What's so special? Tell me what the fuss is about.
Yeah, and really quick on the Buca thing. Sorry, I didn't answer that question. So Bill's theory is that she turned around and flew back to Buca. And what's interesting and impressive about the story and what he's found is that it appears to be, right, a Lockheed Electra kind of embedded in the coral reef out there near the coast of Papua New Guinea. We do know that there were other Electras flying from Papua New Guinea doing mail service around the time that Amelia flew in 1937. So it is possible it could be another plane, similar to a 10E actually as well. I've disagreed with Bill on the basis that the radio call strength as they get stronger to the Itasca would be your first clue on that, why that wouldn't be possible. But I think for me, the strongest evidence is if you look at the radio logs, what they've written down is she says, we never hear this because we always say, we must be on you, cannot see you flying 1,000 feet. We've got that embedded in our heads. You know that when you hear that in your sleep, right?
Oh, yeah.
But if the first couple words on the radio log are actually calling Itasca, she says, calling Itasca. So that immediately puts to bed any idea that she's flying back to. Now, when I mentioned this to Bill, the response is that she didn't actually say that, that they just wrote that down because that's what they would have expected her to be calling. They would have been expecting her to be talking, which is right. He's right about that. That is true. But my interpretation of reading the logs is that is when she says she's 100 miles out, when she says she's 200 miles out, she actually doesn't say, they don't have written down calling Itasca, as you know. They just have about 200 miles out now, but they aren't writing her words down verbatim on those calls. It's only when she gets in at 7:12 that they write in the calling Itasca, presumably because they think that she, but it's signal five strength. They wouldn't be getting from Papua New Guinea. There's no question. And then finally, the last piece is she says, and we're on the line 157337. At that moment, actually, the sun had not come up in Papua New Guinea. It had come up in Howland, as we know, because it just come up, but it had not come up in Papua New Guinea. So for him to have taken a sun line at 157, he couldn't. He couldn't at that moment because it was still dark. It was much further to the west. I think Bill's response to that is that she also didn't say 157. It was what the radio operators thought that she should be saying. So again, that's where I like, well, no, she did say it. She did write it down. They did write it down. So we have to take the evidence as it's presented to us. If we're changing the words and changing what was written down, then the conversation becomes much different, much more difficult. But Bill is very convinced of it. And happily, I would happily join him on the expedition because I'm all about adventure. I would go to Nicomaru or Gardner Island. I think that they've been down there 27 times. I don't think we need to go down there anymore. We beat that horse to death. Nobody really believes that one anymore, anyways. The Marshall Islands is probably the one that I get the most frequently, Chris. As we cleared a lot of the area around the island, then the idea of maybe this was a secretive mission and she was intentionally deceiving us in flying somewhere else, making these radio calls, but actually over the Marshall Islands, right, is now maybe, maybe that there is something to that. I don't believe it. Trust me, it's like a less than a 1% chance. But if there was something secretive going on in this whole thing, it would have had to done with what was happening in the Pacific, which was this buildup by the Japanese in the Marshall Islands. Okay, hey, do you mind flying over this area? Make these radio calls, make the Itasca think that you're coming in, so everybody thinks you're coming in. Maybe Commander Thompson knew was in on it, never said anything. And then mysteriously, she does get shot down, or she accidentally goes down and doesn't make it to Howland, right? Which could be the case out of gas. So, yeah, I mean, there's that possibility. Again, very low probability on that. I don't think they would have been using Amelia for such a mission, but it's in the realm of possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about something you mentioned earlier, and I think it's very powerful, and I think it's worth reiterating a little bit. We're coming up on almost 90 years, 88 years this coming July. I just want to give a little perspective because a lot of people that listen to the show, whether they're veterans of the show and they listen to every episode, or maybe they're just getting into it, I want to give them a little perspective here, and then I'll ask you to weigh in. From the moment the Itasca realizes that something's very wrong on the morning of July 2nd, she, along with the U.S. Navy, they get involved. They kick off one of the largest air-sea searches ever, even to this day. It's a pretty amazing prospect. The Colorado is brought out from Hawaii near Pearl Harbor. They search 26,000 square miles between land and sea within 10 days. They call off the search. And then everybody that you mentioned at the top of the conversation, Dana Timmer, Elgin Long, Nauticos, Bob Ballard, Ted Waite, Rockwell Collins, who I absolutely adore those guys over there. They're geniuses. They've all thrown their hat into the ring. Now Deep Sea Vision, you guys have been out there. And that's just one idea. I think the list will grow. I think you and I can agree the list will grow the longer the plane is out there unfound. I guess there's two ways to look at this. You can look at this and you can just be like, like maybe it's just not going to be found. Or you can just continue to keep that unwavering optimism. Are you comfortable just never knowing?
No, I want to see this answered in my lifetime. Absolutely. No, and I've said this on your show. I've said this here. I'm the biggest cheerleader of finding this. And if it's us, great. If it's somebody, if it's the next group, that's great too. If it's David Jordan's group, I will support every effort that he will. I mean, within reason. I mean, where there is obviously a friendly competition there, but I will support his efforts. I felt the same from him. It's a really small target, right? I mean, and it's a really big ocean. So it's very easy to claim she's not there. She flew back to Buka or she's in the Marshall Islands because we haven't found her. The absence of the plane right now is doesn't support anybody's theories. The flat Earth people are just as right as we are. Nobody's right at this point. So I want to see somebody be right. Nobody's presented anything at this point. I thought we were the closest with the sonar image and turned out that that wasn't. So we will continue. I think we have other theories that are slowly developing within our team on where to go next and what to do. And I know the Rockwell Collins guys, I'm with you. I love what their work, Rod and Tom.
Tom
And
Vinson.
yeah, Tom Vinson, their work is excellent. We got a chance to hang out with them at the Amelia Festival this past year.
Yeah.
Of course, Gary LaPook was there, and Liz Smith and the Nautica. So it was a nice kind of a grouping of a lot of folks in the Purdue University. So back to what I was saying earlier, I think the idea now is that it was maybe more of a math mistake than a flying mistake. I think Amelia gets close to the island, or she's close enough to see the Itasca, close enough to see the smoke, or Baker Island if she happens to be south. You know, the Nikumaru theory, it's never explained well, but if it was explained properly, there is an idea where it could be right? Where she's dead reckoned and she's actually so far south, right? Say she's 100, 150 miles to the south of the island. She turns onto the 157 line and she actually goes the wrong direction. Well, once you've committed one direction or another, south or north, well, you kind of have to go that way, right? You can't go 100 miles and then all of a sudden turn around like, oh man, like we got to go back now. No. Fred's like, no, your meter's on empty. We're out of fuel. Yeah. There's no way we can recover that 80 miles and go back. So once you've committed, if they're 100 miles, 150 miles to the south, and they commit to going south for whatever reason, because they think it's that way on the 157 line, yeah, you could come up with a very, very small scenario where she ends up on Nikumaru. And also to the north, you could come up with an explanation where she ends up flying to an island way to the north because they've chosen the wrong direction and they decide to just keep flying that way. I mean, I don't think Fred goes in one direction and just goes that way. I think he's doing a box. When she says, for example, we heard your signals, that's a really key moment for everybody, but it's a very key moment for her in the plane as well, because what she's telling us is, I'm hearing you very loud and clear. I know we're close. Take yourself out of the Itasca radio booth for a second and put yourself in the cockpit. She's hearing those signals super loud, the tapping, the Morse code. She's hearing that really loud. She's anchored to that location. The Rockwell Collins guys know pretty closely how far they would have had to have been for that to be an S5 call and for her to have received those Morse codes. So they're close. The worst that can happen at this point is to ditch and be close to the boat. That's the worst that can happen. The best is we keep flying kind of concentric circles and we kind of go further and further out or do kind of a box search and we look in the area that we're in, because if we go too far away, the boat's never going to find us. So at least we know if we crash, the Itasca could find us on the water, you know, especially if the airplane stayed afloat for a few minutes. So
yeah.
The last point that I want to make on it, and I think that makes this thing a little bit difficult, is we don't know if the plane floated on the surface, right?
Right.
We don't know if it could have floated or how long it could have. We know that there was a big, wide search done with the planes you mentioned from the Colorado, but if this thing stayed afloat for 24, 48 hours, you look at the drift analysis on maps on the internet, they all point west. I can tell you, Chris, for a fact on this show right now, that is not true. We drifted out there while we were letting the AUV do its thing. And, you know, we collected a lot of really good proprietary data. It's not consistent and it's not what we thought it was. Mm. And that could put the plane in a completely different direction than you would expect if you were trying to do this as a drift analysis. Then you have this kind of interim zone from the surface down to 600 meters where you do have a current, right? It's going a different direction than the surface. Believe it or not, the surface is going one direction. Then you have 200 to 300 meters where it's actually going a different direction. That's going to push it slightly off from where its splash point was. So you've got the impact point, how far it drifted. Then you've got how far it drifted underwater. Then you got to wonder how long did it take to get to the bottom of the seafloor, right?
Yeah.
If it hits a point where it's slowly drifting down, maybe becomes neutrally buoyant, which is kind of hard to imagine a scenario like that, but there's just enough air to kind of keep it maybe 10 or 20 feet below the surface, but it's not quite sinking. I mean, we've all sort of seen this in swimming pools, right? You drop something in and the toy doesn't go to the right. I mean, it's possible. These are big fuel tanks and it stays submerged. So you can't see it from a search from a plane and it stays submerged for, you know, weeks, right? And it just doesn't.
Yeah.
Again, very small probability, but if you're starting to line up the improbables, you got to put that on the list.
Yeah, I only have one more question, but as you're talking, I did want to bring something else up. What are the odds the longer this thing goes, pardon my French, but it's a big ass ocean. So is it just that it's just a really vast area and it's just, you know, it's a tough nail to nail down? Or do you really have to start considering that maybe, you know, something is wrong here? And you could look at this as really there's only two options. You've expertly laid it out tonight. Amelia's voice, her own voice, the Itasca logs, Bellart's testimony, everybody who was on board in that radio room. You have the official U.S. government story. Anybody who comes to the plate that's presenting anything alternative has to give you something earth-shatteringly good to shake that in any way, shape, or form. We've got something at Buka that's just, it just doesn't feel right. When do you start really looking at those options as a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were looking at everything from the beginning.
You were, absolutely.
We were everything. Yeah. I mean, when we started this research, and I'm very proud to say we used all of our own money for this. This was, you know, this was all privately funded, and it's not cheap. We didn't take anybody else's money. I think it makes a difference, right? It's sort of like, you know, how the government, they don't care. They just waste your money. It's somebody else's money, right? And this is why the private sector always be more efficient, more productive with the spend. And same here, it was our money. And if we're going to do this, let's pick areas and sectors that we really feel like we have a high probability chance of finding the airplane. And we're not, you know, and this isn't, you know, wild goose hunt or just a fun vacation on somebody else's dime. This is our money. We're spending it in a very serious way. It's also a business, by the way. You know, you mentioned Deep Sea Vision. We're doing a lot of work on minerals. We did two mineral projects after this. We're getting ready to go to possibly Africa and do some oil and gas work, and then maybe the Mediterranean and do a couple shipwreck hunts. So, I mean, we've got some fun stuff on the docket. But to get back to your question, I think after you lay out all the improbable and you go after the most probable, then you've eliminated, like Sherlock Holmes, I think, said, once you've eliminated the all the probable, then it's the improbable does become probable, right?
You have to look at it. Yeah, you have to look at it.
But I think that's what makes this thing so fun, right? And that's what, like, your audience is growing and growing and the plot thickens. I've said that a number of times. It adds to the mystery, right? It makes it even more exciting when this thing is eventually found. And I hope it is found in our lifetime. You know, we will all come together, the community, all the folks that have really care about the story in a genuine way will come together and celebrate that and meet at the Smithsonian. I can't wait to see it in the Smithsonian with David Jordan there, with Ted Waite, who I've never spoke to. I'd like to at some point, you know, and, you know, Liz Smith.
Oh, I could put you in touch with Ted if you need to.
I'd love to. I have a lot of respect for what those guys did. Purdue University and you know, just recently, last week, actually, I don't know if you know this, Amy Kleppner passed away.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so that was the kind of the final link. That was, of course, Amelia's niece, Muriel's daughter.
That's right.
Kind of the torch got passed to Bram Kleppner.
Yeah.
We also spoke with, I forget the lady's name. She was 104 years old. She was the last person to have met or really, I think, flown with Amelia up in New Jersey. I don't know if you ever talked to her.
Oh, yes. God, and the name escapes me. But yes, I knew exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah. We had a Zoom call with her, a couple months ago, right before she passed away, which was absolutely incredible. Because we thought there was nobody still alive that had knew Amelia or talked to Amelia. And here we were finding this lady that she'd been 16 years old and went on a flight with Amelia when she was in high school. She came into our high school and picked two people to go flying with her. Really cool story. I will be super excited when they do the opening of the Smithsonian and everybody will be there and it'll be a very nice moment. And all the wonderful folks there at the Amelia Museum in Atchison, Kansas. I hope. And you'll be there, I'm sure. You'll
God willing.
Part of the exhibit. So it's such a great story, man. And you know, Liz said it really well. Once this plane is found, maybe we can move more towards her story and what she stood for. Because I really think she was one of the most progressive women. And she's remembered as being this aviator that was lost. That mystery versus as a pioneer and an early feminist, early advocate for women's rights, excellent author, 20 hours and 40 minutes. And what was her other book?
The Fun of It.
The Fun of It. Thank you. Yeah.
As you said on the first conversation, she's very witty. She's very charming. I say this all the time when I do media and stuff. I kind of compare it to like Marilyn Monroe. If you read a lot of her stuff, like Marilyn Monroe, like she could just turn it on. She was two different people. She could turn it on when it was media time or when people wanted to interview her or talk to her, take photos. Talking to a lot of the Putnam family members and people, I mean, Earhart was a lot of the same thing. She just kind of flipped it like a switch.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, one thing she doesn't get enough credit for is how difficult this flight was around the world in so many regards, right? The exhaustion, the time, the jet lag, but also she was a celebrity. Every place she was landing, she was being hosted as a guest. And she talks about that in her book. Like, this is just exhausting. People, they take us out to dinner. And here we are getting up at 4 or 5 a.m. so that we're taking off before sunrise. And we just have, you know, this whole night of entertaining. And so she would have to force herself to go to bed, but every single stop along the way, and she's getting treated out by kings and royalty and officers and these military bases. And it was just an exhausting flight on top of sightseeing and then making sure the airplane was in good condition, properly maintained. Managing Fred, right? And maybe some of the issues that were happening along the way. Sure. Not that many, I don't think, but there were a few. And then the whole trip was extremely difficult. And then you're flying into areas that many places had never even seen white people in Africa, and that runways were barely even in. And they were being treated for malaria and different things in Australia. And I think in some areas, not treated very well, very nicely by some of the local folks. So, I mean, it was an extremely difficult flight. I'd like to bring some more respect to her and how good of a pod, how good of she was. She was managing all of that. Really fortunate she didn't make it all the way around the world. I really wish she had. Yeah, she was just such an incredible person.
All the more reason to find her. Tony, this was a pleasure as always. I appreciate you. I know how slammed you are and how busy you are with all of this. Thank you for coming on the show and sitting down with me again almost a year later. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I hope we'll be back, Chris. We've been asked a lot when the next expedition is, and I know you're sensitive on that because, you know, we don't like to give out too many of our plans, but
Sure, of
we are,
course.
it's in the works. But I'd love to get back on and chat
Yeah.
more about and as things develop in the search, and I think there's some maybe some collaborative plans coming together. Hopefully we can chat about that too.
Absolutely. So it's in the works. So relax, people. We got some good people on it.
Not
It's
25. I can confirm we are not going back in 2025. Nothing on the books for that unless we are right near American Samoa or Kiribati. But at the moment, we aren't scheduled to be in it. This was actually, we weren't even, we were lucky we were able to put this expedition in. We just had a kind of a last minute trip from Australia across the ocean. So we said, why not? And we picked up a couple other jobs in Samoa, and it all worked out well. But right now, we don't have anything scheduled for 25. So maybe 2026. We'll see. But I do think we need to step back a little bit. I need to step back and really we need to look through the data, what we have, be 100% sure we haven't missed it. This is so much data, 7,000 some square miles of data. You know, I think we
Jesus.
did a pretty thorough job, but I'd like to write some AI that could go through, look at these sonar returns in a way that the human eye is not able to do. Maybe it'll pick out something that we missed. So that is the things that I'd like to do before we go back out there.
You never know. The search continues. Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much,
Thank you.
sir.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.